Effect of convertible issues on the status of the common stock. In a large number of cases, convertibles have been issued in connection with mergers or new acquisitions. Perhaps the most striking example of this financial operation was the issuance by the NVF Corporation of nearly $100 million of its 5% convertible bonds plus warrants in exchange for most of the common stock of Sharon Steel Company. Typically, the transaction results in a pro forma increase in the reported earnings per share of common stock. The shares advance in response to their larger earnings, so-called, but also because the management has given evidence of its energy, enterprise, and ability to make more money for the shareholders. But there are two offsetting factors, one of which is practically ignored, and the other entirely so in optimistic markets. The first is the actual dilution of the current and future earnings on the common stock that flows arithmetically from the new conversion rights. This dilution can be quantified by taking the recent earnings, or assuming some other figures, and calculating the adjusted earnings per share if all the convertible shares or bonds were actually converted. In the majority of companies, the resulting reduction in per-share figures is not significant, but there are numerous exceptions to this statement, and there is danger that they will grow at an uncomfortable rate. The fast-expanding conglomerates have been the chief practitioners of convertible ledger domain. In Table 16.3, which can be found on the enhancement, we list 7 companies with large amounts of stock issuable on conversions or against warrants. Indicated switches from common into preferred stocks. For decades before, say, 1956, common stocks yielded more than the preferred stocks of the same companies. This was particularly true if the preferred stock had a conversion privilege close to the market. The reverse is generally true at present. As a result, there are a considerable number of convertible preferred stocks, which are clearly more attractive than the related common shares. Owners of the common have nothing to lose and important advantages to gain by switching from their junior shares into the senior issue. Example. A typical example was presented by Studebaker Worthington Corporation at the close of 1970. The common sold at 57, while the $5 convertible preferred finished at 87.5. Each preferred share is exchangeable for 1.5 shares of common, then worth 85.5. This would indicate a small money difference against the buyer of the preferred. But dividends are being paid on the common at the annual rate of $1.20, or $1.80 for the 1.5 shares, against the $5 obtainable on one share of preferred. Thus, the original adverse difference in price would probably be made up in less than a year, after which the preferred would probably return an appreciably higher dividend yield than the common for some time to come. But most important, of course, would be the senior position that the common shareholder would gain from the switch. At the low prices of 1968 and again in 1970, the preferred sold 15 points higher than 1.5 shares of common. Its conversion privilege guarantees that it could never sell lower than the common package. Stock option warrants. Let us mince no words at the outset. We consider the recent development of stock option warrants as a near fraud, an existing menace, and a potential disaster. They have created huge aggregate dollar values out of thin air. They have no excuse for existence, except to the extent that they mislead speculators and investors. They should be prohibited by law, or at least strictly limited to a minor part of the total capitalization of a company. For an analogy in general history and in literature, we refer the listener to the section of Faust, Part 2, in which Goethe describes the invention of paper money. As an ominous precedent on Wall Street history, we may mention the warrants of American and Foreign Power Company, which in 1929 had a quoted market value of over $1 billion, although they appeared only in a footnote to the company's balance sheet. By 1932, this $1 billion had shrunk to $8 million, and in 1952, the warrants were wiped out in the company's recapitalization, even though it had remained solvent. Originally, stock option warrants were attached now and then to bond issues, and were usually equivalent to a partial conversion privilege. They were unimportant in amount and hence did no harm. Their use expanded in the late 1920s, along with many other financial abuses, but they dropped from sight for long years thereafter. They were bound to turn up again, like the bad pennies they are. And since 1967, they have become familiar instruments of finance. In fact, a standard procedure has developed for raising the capital for new real estate ventures, affiliates of large banks, by selling units of an equal number of common shares and warrants to buy additional common shares at the same price. Example, in 1971, Cleve Trust Realty Investors sold 2,500,000 of these combinations of common stock, or shares of beneficial interest and warrants, for $20 per unit. Let us consider for a moment what is really involved in this financial setup. Ordinarily, a common stock issue has the first right to buy additional common shares when the company's directors find it desirable to raise capital in this manner. This so-called preemptive right is one of the elements of value entering into the ownership of common stock, along with the right to receive dividends, to participate in the company's growth, and to vote for directors. When separate warrants are issued for the right to subscribe additional capital, that action takes away part of the value inherent in an ordinary common share, and transfers it to a separate certificate. An analogous thing could be done by issuing separate certificates for the right to receive dividends, for a limited or unlimited period, or the right to share in the proceeds of sale or liquidation of the enterprise, or the right to vote the shares. Why then are these subscription warrants created as part of the original capital structure? Simply because people are inexpert in financial matters. They don't realize that the common stock is worth less with warrants outstanding than otherwise. Hence, the package of stock and warrants usually commands a better price in the market than would the stock alone. Note that in the usual company reports, the per-share earnings are or have been computed without proper allowance for the effect of outstanding warrants. The result is, of course, to overstate the true relationship between the earnings and the market value of the company's capitalization. The simplest and probably the best method of allowing for the existence of warrants is to add the equivalent of their market value to the common share capitalization, thus increasing the true market price per share. Where large amounts of warrants have been issued in connection with the sale of senior securities, it is customary to make the adjustment by assuming that the proceeds of the stock payment are used to retire the related bonds or preferred shares. This method does not allow adequately for the usual premium value of a warrant above exercisable value. In Table 16.4, which you can find on the enhancement, we compare the effect of the two methods of calculation in the case of National General Corporation for the year 1970. Does the company itself derive an advantage from the creation of these warrants, in the sense that they assure it in some way of receiving additional capital when it needs some? Not at all. Ordinarily, there is no way in which the company can require the warrant holders to exercise their rights, and thus provide new capital to the company, prior to the expiration date of the warrants. In the meantime, if the company wants to raise additional common stock funds, it must offer the shares to its shareholders in the usual way, which means somewhat under the ruling market price. The warrants are no help in such an operation. They merely complicate the situation by frequently requiring a downward revision in their own subscription price. Once more, we assert that large issues of stock option warrants serve no purpose, except to fabricate imaginary market values. The paper money that Goethe was familiar with when he wrote his Faust were the notorious French assignats that had been greeted as a marvelous invention and were destined ultimately to lose all of their value, as did the $1 billion worth of American and foreign power warrants. Some of the poet's remarks apply equally well to one invention or another, such as the following in Bayard Taylor's translation. Faust. Imagination in its highest flight exerts itself, but cannot grasp it quite. Mephistopheles, the inventor. If one needs coin, the broker's ready stand. The Fool, finally. The magic paper! Practical postscript. The crime of the warrants is in having been born. Once born, they function as other security forms and offer chances of profit as well as of loss. Nearly all the newer warrants run for a limited time, generally between 5 and 10 years. The older warrants were often perpetual, and they were likely to have fascinating price histories over the years. Example: the record books will show that Tri-Continental Corporation warrants, which date from 1929, sold at a negligible 1/32nd of a dollar each in the depth of the Depression. From that lowly estate, their price rose to a magnificent 75¾ in 1969, an astronomical advance of some 242,000%. The warrants then sold considerably higher than the shares themselves. This is the kind of thing that occurs on Wall Street through technical developments, such as stock splits. A recent example is supplied by Ling Temco Vought warrants, which in the first half of 1971 advanced from 2.5 to 12.5, and then fell back to 4. No doubt shrewd operations can be carried on in warrants from time to time, but this is too technical a matter for discussion here. We might say that warrants tend to sell relatively higher than the corresponding market components related to the conversion privilege of bonds or preferred stocks. To that extent, there is a valid argument for selling bonds with warrants attached rather than creating an equivalent dilution factor by a convertible issue. If the warrant total is relatively small, there is no point in taking its theoretical aspect too seriously. If the warrant issue is large relative to the outstanding stock, that would probably indicate that the company has a top-heavy senior capitalization. It should be selling additional common stock instead. Thus, the main objective of our attack on warrants as a financial mechanism is not to condemn their use in connection with moderate-size bond issues, but to argue against the wanton creation of huge paper money monstrosities of this genre. Commentary on Chapter 16. That which thou sowest is not quickened, except it die. 1 Corinthians 15:36. The zeal of the convert. Although convertible bonds are called bonds, they behave like stocks, work like options, and are cloaked in obscurity. If you own a convertible, you also hold an option. You can either keep the bond and continue to earn interest on it, or you can exchange it for common stock of the issuing company at a predetermined ratio. An option gives its owner the right to buy or sell another security at a given price within a specific period of time. Because they are exchangeable into stock, convertibles pay lower rates of interest than most comparable bonds. On the other hand, if a company's stock price soars, a convertible bond exchangeable into that stock will perform much better than a conventional bond. Conversely, the typical convertible with its lower interest rate will fare worse in a falling bond market. From 1957 through 2002, according to Ibbotson Associates, convertible bonds earned an annual average return of 8.3%. Only 2 percentage points below the total return on stocks, but with steadier prices and shallower losses. More income, less risk than stocks. No wonder Wall Street salespeople often describe convertibles as a best of both worlds investment. But the intelligent investor will quickly realize that convertibles offer less income and more risk than most other bonds. So they could, by the same logic and with equal justice, be called a worst-of-both-worlds investment. Which side you come down on depends on how you use them. In truth, convertibles act more like stocks than bonds. The return on convertibles is about 83%, correlated to the Standard & Poor's 500 stock index, but only about 30% correlated to the performance of treasury bonds. Thus, converts zig when most bonds zag. For conservative investors with most or all of their assets in bonds, Adding a diversified bundle of converts is a sensible way to seek stock-like returns without having to take the scary step of investing in stocks directly. You could call convertible bonds stocks for chickens. As convertibles expert F. Barry Nelson of Advent Capital Management points out, this roughly $200 billion market has blossomed since Graham's day. Most converts are now medium term in the 7 to 10 year range. Roughly half are investment grade, and many issues now carry some call protection and assurance against early redemption. All these factors make them less risky than they used to be. It's expensive to trade small lots of convertible bonds, and diversification is impractical unless you have well over $100,000 to invest in this sector alone. Fortunately, today's intelligent investor has the convenient recourse of buying a low-cost convertible bond fund. Fidelity and Vanguard offer mutual funds with annual expenses comfortably under 1%, while several closed-end funds are also available at a reasonable cost, and occasionally at discounts to net asset value. On Wall Street, cuteness and complexity go hand in hand, and convertibles are no exception. Among the newer varieties are a jumble of securities with acronymic nicknames like Lions, Elks, Eyes, Perks, MIPS, Chips, and Yields. These intricate securities put a floor under your potential losses, but also cap your potential profits and often compel you to convert into common stock on a fixed date. Like most investments that purport to insure against loss, these things are generally more trouble than they are worth. You can best shield yourself against loss not by buying one of these quirky contraptions, but by intelligently diversifying your entire portfolio across cash, bonds, and U.S. and foreign stocks. Uncovering covered calls. As the bear market clawed its way through 2003, it dug up an old fad, writing covered call options. A recent Google search on covered call writing turned up more than 2,600 hits. What are covered calls, and how do they work? Imagine that you buy 100 shares of Ixnay Corporation at $95 apiece. You then sell or write a call option on your shares. In exchange, you get a cash payment known as a call premium. Let's say it's $10 per share. The buyer of the option, meanwhile, has the contractual right to buy your Ixnay shares at a mutually agreed-upon price, say $100. You get to keep the stock so long as it stays below $100, and you earn a fat $1,000 in premium income, which will cushion the fall if Ixnay stock crashes. Less risk, more income. What's not to like? Well, now imagine that Ixnay's stock price jumps overnight to $110. Then your option buyer will exercise his rights, yanking your shares away for $100 apiece. You've still got your $1,000 in income, but he's got your Ixnay, and the more it goes up, the harder you'll kick yourself. Since the potential gain on a stock is unlimited, while no loss can exceed 100%, the only person you will enrich with this strategy is your broker. You've put a floor under your losses, but you've also slapped a ceiling over your gains. For individual investors, covering your downside is never worth surrendering most of your upside. Chapter 17. Four extremely instructive case histories. The word extremely in the title is a kind of pun, because the histories represent extremes of various sorts that were manifest on Wall Street in recent years. They hold instruction and grave warnings for everyone who has a serious connection with the world of stocks and bonds, not only for ordinary investors and speculators, but for professionals, security analysts, fund managers, trust account administrators, and even for bankers who lend money to corporations. The four companies to be reviewed, and the different extremes that they illustrate, are Penn Central Railroad Company, an extreme example of the neglect of the most elementary warning signals of financial weakness by all those who had bonds or shares of this system under their supervision. a crazily high market price for the stock of a tottering giant. Ling Temco Vought Incorporated. An extreme example of quick and unsound empire building, with ultimate collapse practically guaranteed, but helped by indiscriminate bank lending. NVF Corporation. An extreme example of one corporate acquisition in which a small company absorbed another 7 times its size, incurring a huge debt and employing some startling accounting devices. AAA Enterprises. An extreme example of public stock financing of a small company, its value based on the magic word franchising and little else, sponsored by important stock exchange houses. Bankruptcy followed within 2 years of the stock sale and the doubling of the initial inflated price in the heedless stock market. The Penn Central case. This is the country's largest railroad in assets and gross revenues. Its bankruptcy in 1970 shocked the financial world. It has defaulted on most of its bond issues and has been in danger of abandoning its operations entirely. Its security issues fell drastically in price, the common stock collapsing from a high level of 86.5 as recently as 1968 to a low of 5.5 in 1970. There seems little doubt that these shares will be wiped out in reorganization. Our basic point is that the application of the simplest rules of security analysis and the simplest standards of sound investment would have revealed the fundamental weakness of the Penn Central system long before its bankruptcy, certainly in 1968 when the shares were selling at their post-1929 record, and when most of its bond issues could have been exchanged at even prices for well-secured public utility obligations with the same coupon rates. The following comments are in order. 1. In the S&P Bond Guide, the interest charges of the system are shown to have been earned 1.91 times in 1967 and 1.98 times in 1968. The minimum coverage prescribed for railroad bonds in our textbook security analysis is 5 times before income taxes and 2.9 times after income taxes at regular rates. As far as we know, the validity of these standards has never been questioned by any investment authority. On the basis of our requirements for earnings after taxes, the Penn Central fell short of the requirements for safety. But our after-tax requirement is based on a before-tax ratio of 5 times, with regular income tax deducted after the bond interest. In the case of Penn Central, it had been paying no income taxes to speak of for the past 11 years. Hence, the coverage of its interest charges before taxes was less than 2 times, a totally inadequate figure against our conservative requirement of 5 times. 2. The fact that the company paid no income taxes over so long a period should have raised serious questions about the validity of its reported earnings. 3. The bonds of the Penn Central system could have been exchanged in 1968 and 1969 at no sacrifice of price or income for far better secured issues. For example, in 1969, Pennsylvania Railroad 4.5s due 1994, part of Penn Central, had a range of 61 to 74.5, while Pennsylvania Electric Company 4.375s due 1994 had a range of 64.25 to 72.25. The public utility had earned its interest 4.2 times before taxes in 1968. Against only 1.98 times for the Penn Central system. During 1969, the latter's comparative showing grew steadily worse. An exchange of this sort was clearly called for, and it would have been a lifesaver for a Penn Central bondholder. At the end of 1970, the railroad 4.25s were in default and selling at only 18.5, while the utility's 4.375s closed at 66.5. 4. Penn Central reported earnings of $3.80 per share in 1968. Its high price of 86.5 in that year was 24 times such earnings. But any analyst worth his salt would have wondered how real were earnings of this sort reported without the necessity of paying any income taxes thereon. 5. For 1966, the newly merged company had reported earnings of $6.80 a share, in reflection of which the common stock later rose to its peak of 86.5. This was a valuation of over $2 billion for the equity. How many of these buyers knew at the time that the so lovely earnings were before a special charge of $275 million, or $12 per share, to be taken in 1971 for costs and losses incurred on the merger? Oh, wondrous fairyland of Wall Street, where a company can announce profits of $6.80 per share in one place, and special costs and losses of $12 in another. And shareholders and speculators rub their hands with glee. 6. A railroad analyst would have long since known that the operating picture of the Penn Central was very bad in comparison with the more profitable roads. For example, its transportation ratio was 47.5% in 1968. Against 35.2% for its neighbor, Norfolk and Western. 7. Along the way, there were some strange transactions with peculiar accounting results. Details are too complicated to go into here. Conclusion. Whether better management could have saved the Penn Central bankruptcy may be arguable, but there is no doubt whatever that no bonds and no shares of the Penn Central system should have remained after 1968 at the latest in any securities account watched over by competent security analysts, fund managers, trust officers, or investment counsel. Moral? Security analysts should do their elementary jobs before they study stock market movements, gaze into crystal balls, make elaborate mathematical calculations, or go on all-expense-paid field trips. Ling Temco Vought Incorporated. This is a story of head-over-heels expansion and head-over-heels debt, ending up in terrific losses and a host of financial problems. As usually happens in such cases, a fair-haired boy, or young genius, was chiefly responsible for both the creation of the great empire and its ignominious downfall. But there is plenty of blame to be accorded others as well. The rise and fall of Ling Temco Vought can be summarized by setting forth condensed income accounts and balance sheet items for 5 years between 1958 and 1970. This is done in Table 17-1, which can be viewed on the enhancement. The first column shows the company's modest beginnings in 1958, when its sales were only $7 million. The next gives figures for 1960. The enterprise had grown 20-fold in only 2 years, but it was still comparatively small. Then came the heyday years to 1967 and 1968, in which sales again grew 20-fold to $2.8 billion, with the debt figure expanding from $44 million to an awesome $1,653 million. In 1969 came new acquisitions, a further huge increase in debt to a total of $1,865 million, and the beginning of serious trouble. A large loss, after extraordinary items, was reported for the year. The stock price declined from its 1967 high of 169.5 to a low of 24. The young genius was superseded as the head of the company. The 1970 results were even more dreadful. The enterprise reported a final net loss of close to $70 million. The stock fell away to a low price of 7 1/8, and its largest bond issue was quoted at one time at a pitiable 15 cents on the dollar. The company's expansion policy was sharply reversed. Various of its important interests were placed on the market, and some headway was made in reducing its mountainous obligations. The figures in our table speak so eloquently that few comments are called for. But here are some. 1. The company's expansion period was not without an interruption. In 1961, it showed a small operating deficit, but adopting a practice that was to be seen later in so many reports for 1970, evidently decided to throw all possible charges and reserves into the one bad year. These amounted to around $13 million, which was more than the combined net profits of the preceding 3 years. It was now ready to show record earnings in 1962, etc. 2. At the end of 1966, the net tangible assets are given as $7.66 per share of common, adjusted for a 3-for-2 split. Thus, the market price in 1967 reached 22 times its reported asset value at the time. At the end of 1968, the balance sheet showed $286 million available for 3,800,000 shares of common and Class AA stock, or about $77 per share. But if we deduct the preferred stock at full value and exclude the goodwill items and the huge bond discount asset, there would remain $13 million for the common, a mere $3 per share. This tangible equity was wiped out by the losses of the following years. 3. Toward the end of 1967, two of our best-regarded banking firms offered 600,000 shares of Ling Temco Vought stock at $111 per share. It had been as high as $169.50. In less than 3 years, the price fell to 7 1/8. 4. At the end of 1967, the bank loans had reached $161 million, and a year later they stood at $414 million, which should have been a frightening figure. In addition, the long-term debt amounted to $1,237 million. By 1969, combined debt reached a total of $1,869 million. This may have been the largest combined debt figure of any industrial company anywhere and at any time, with a single exception of the impregnable Standard Oil of New Jersey. 5. The losses in 1969 and 1970 far exceeded the total profits since the formation of the company. Moral. The primary question raised in our mind by the Ling Temco Vought story is how the commercial bankers could have been persuaded to lend the company such huge amounts of money during its expansion period. In 1966 and earlier, the company's coverage of interest charges did not meet conservative standards, and the same was true of the ratio of current assets to current liabilities and of stock equity to total debt. But in the next 2 years, the banks advanced the enterprise nearly $400 million additional for further diversification. This was not good business for them, and it was worse in its implications for the company's shareholders. If the Ling Temco Vought case will serve to keep commercial banks from aiding and abetting unsound expansions of this type in the future, some good may come of it at last. The NVF takeover of Sharon Steel, a collector's item. At the end of 1968, NVF Company was a company with $4.6 million of long-term debt, $17.4 million of stock capital, $31 million of sales, and $502,000 of net income, before a special credit of $374,000. Its business was described as vulcanized fiber and plastics. The management decided to take over the Sharon Steel Corporation, which had $43 million of long-term debt, $101 million of stock capital, $219 million of sales, and $2,929,000 of net earnings. The company it wished to acquire was thus seven times the size of NVF. In early 1969, it made an offer for all the shares of Sharon. The terms per share was $70 face amount of NVF Junior 5% bonds, due 1994, plus warrants to buy 1.5 shares of NVF stock at $22 per share of NVF. The management of Sharon strenuously resisted this takeover attempt, but in vain. NVF acquired 88% of the Sharon stock under the offer, issuing therefore $102 million of its 5% bonds and warrants for 2,197,000 of its shares. Had the offer been 100% operative, the consolidated enterprise would, for the year 1968, have had $163 million in debt, only $2.2 million in tangible stock capital, $250 million of sales. The net earnings question would have been a bit complicated, but the company subsequently stated them as a net loss of 50 cents per share of NVF stocks, before an extraordinary credit and net earnings of 3 cents per share after such credit. First comment. Among all the takeovers effected in the year 1969, this was no doubt the most extreme in its financial disproportions. The acquiring company had assumed responsibility for a new and top-heavy debt obligation, and it had changed its calculated 1968 earnings from a profit to a loss into the bargain. A measure of the impairment of the company's financial position by this step is found in the fact that the new 5% bonds did not sell higher than 42 cents on the dollar during the year of issuance. This would have indicated grave doubt of the safety of the bonds and of the company's future. However, the management actually exploited the bond price in a way to save the company annual income taxes of about $1 million, as will be shown. The 1968 report, published after the Sharon takeover, contained a condensed picture of its results, carried back to the year-end. This contained two most unusual items. One, there is listed as an asset $58,600,000 of deferred debt expense. This sum is greater than the entire stockholders' equity, placed at $40,200,000. Two. However, not included in the shareholders' equity is an item of $20,700,000 designated as excess of equity over cost of investment in Sharon. Second comment. If we eliminate the debt expense as an asset, which it hardly seems to be, and include the other item in the shareholders' equity, where it would normally belong, then we have a more realistic statement of tangible equity for NVF stock, $2,200,000. Thus, the first effect of the deal was to reduce NVF's real equity from $17,400,000 to $2,200,000, or from $23.71 per share to about $3 per share on 731,000 shares. In addition, the NVF shareholders had given to others the right to buy 3.5 times as many additional shares at 6 points below the market price at the close of 1968. The initial market value of the warrants was then about $12 each, or a total of some $30 million for those involved in the purchase offer. Actually, the market value of the warrants well exceeded the total market value of the outstanding NVF stock. Another evidence of the tail-wagging-dog nature of the transaction. The accounting gimmicks. When we pass from this pro forma balance sheet to the next year's report, we find several strange-appearing entries. In addition to the basic interest expense, a hefty $7,500,000, there is deducted $1,795,000 for amortization of deferred debt expense. But this last is nearly offset on the next line by a very unusual income item indeed. Amortization of equity over cost of investment in subsidiary, CR $1,650,000. In one of the footnotes we find an entry, not appearing in any other report that we know of. Part of the stock capital is there designated as fair market value of warrants issued in connection with acquisition, etc., $22,129,000. What on earth do all these entries mean? None of them is even referred to in the descriptive text of the 1969 report. The trained security analyst has to figure out these mysteries by himself, almost in detective fashion. He finds that the underlying idea is to derive a tax advantage from the low initial price of the 5% debentures. For listeners who may be interested in this ingenious arrangement, we set forth our solution in Appendix 6. Other unusual items. 1. Right after the close of 1969, the company bought in no less than 650,000 warrants at a price of $9.38 each. This was extraordinary when we consider that A, NVF itself had only $700,000 in cash at the year-end, and had $4,400,000 of debt due in 1970. Evidently, the $6 million paid for the warrants had to be borrowed. B. It was buying in this warrant paper money at a time when its 5% bonds were selling at less than 40 cents on the dollar, ordinarily a warning that financial difficulties lay ahead. 2. As a partial offset to this, the company had retired $5,100,000 of its bonds, along with 253,000 warrants, in exchange for a like amount of common stock. This was possible because, by the vagaries of the securities markets, people were selling the 5% bonds at less than 40, while the common sold at an average price of 13.5, paying no dividend. 3. The company had plans in operation not only for selling stock to its employees, but also for selling them a large number of warrants to buy the stock. Like the stock purchases, the warrants were to be paid for 5% down, and the rest over many years in the future. This is the only such employee purchase plan for warrants that we know of. Will someone soon invent and sell on installments a right to buy a share? And so on. 4. In the year 1969, the newly controlled Share and Steel Company changed its method of arriving at its pension costs, and also adopted lower depreciation rates. These accounting changes added about $1 per share to the reported earnings of NVF before dilution. 5. At the end of 1970, Standard & Poor's Stock Guide reported that NVF shares were selling at a price-to-earning ratio of only 2. The lowest figure for all the 4,500-odd issues in the booklet. As the old Wall Street saying went, this was important if true. The ratio was based on the year's closing price of 8.75 and the computed earnings of $5.38 per share for the 12 months ended September 1970. Using these figures, the shares were selling at only 1.6 times earnings. But this ratio did not allow for the large dilution factor, nor for the adverse results actually realized in the last quarter of 1970. When the full year's figures finally appeared, they showed only $2.03 per share earned for the stock, before allowing for dilution, and $1.80 per share on a diluted basis. Note also that the aggregate market price of the stock and warrants on that date was about $14 million, against a bonded debt of $135 million. A skimpy equity position indeed. AAA Enterprises. History. About 15 years ago, a college student named Williams began selling mobile homes, then called trailers. In 1965, he incorporated his business. In that year, he sold $5,800,000 of mobile homes and earned $61,000 before corporate tax. By 1968, he had joined the franchising movement and was selling others the right to sell mobile homes under his business name. He also conceived the bright idea of going into the business of preparing income tax returns, using his mobile homes as offices. He formed a subsidiary company called Mr. Tax of America, and, of course, started to sell franchises to others to use the idea and the name. He multiplied the number of corporate shares to 2,710,000 and was ready for a stock offering. He found that one of our largest stock exchange houses, along with others, was willing to handle the deal. In March 1969, they offered the public 500,000 shares of AAA Enterprises at $13 per share. Of these, 300,000 were sold for Mr. Williams' personal account, and 200,000 were sold for the company account, adding $2,400,000 to its resources. The price of the stock promptly doubled to 28, or a value of $84 million for the equity, against a book value of, say, $4,200,000 and maximum reported earnings of $690,000. The stock was thus selling at a tidy 115 times its current and largest earnings per share. No doubt Mr. Williams had selected the name AAA Enterprise so that it might be among the first in the phone books and the yellow pages. A collateral result was that his company was destined to appear as the first name in Standard & Poor's stock guide. Like Abu Ben Adams, it led all the rest. This gives a special reason to select it as a harrowing example of 1969 new financing and hot issues. Comment: this was not a bad deal for Mr. Williams. The 300,000 shares he sold had a book value in December of 1968 of $180,000, and he netted therefore 20 times as much, or a cool $3,600,000. The underwriters and distributors split $500,000 between them, less expenses. 1. This did not seem so brilliant a deal for the clients of the selling houses. They were asked to pay about 10 times the book value of the stock, after the bootstrap operation of increasing their equity per share from 59 cents to $1.35 with their own money. Before the best year, 1968, the company's maximum earnings had been a ridiculous 7 cents per share. There were ambitious plans for the future, of course, but the public was being asked to pay heavily in advance for the hoped-for realization of these plans. 2. Nonetheless, the price of the stock doubled soon after original issuance, and any one of the brokerage house clients could have gotten out at a handsome profit. Did this fact alter the flotation, or did the advance possibility that it might happen exonerate the original distributors of the issue from responsibility for this public offering and its later sequel? Not an easy question to answer, but it deserves careful consideration by Wall Street and the government regulatory agencies. Subsequent history. With its enlarged capital, AAA Enterprises went into 2 additional businesses. In 1969, it opened a chain of retail carpet stores, and it acquired a plant that manufactured mobile homes. The results reported for the first 9 months were not exactly brilliant, but they were a little better than the year before, 22 cents a share against 14 cents. What happened in the next months was literally incredible. The company lost $4,365,000, or $1.49 per share. This consumed all its capital before the financing, plus the entire $2,400,000 received on the sale of the stock, plus 2/3 of the amount reported as earned in the first 9 months of 1969. There was left a pathetic $242,000, or 8 cents per share, of capital for the public shareholders who had paid $13 for the new offering only 7 months before. Nonetheless, the shares closed the year 1969 at 8 1/8 bid, or a valuation of more than $25 million for the company. Further comment. 1. It is too much to believe that the company had actually earned $686,000 from January to September 1969. And then lost $4,365,000 in the next 3 months. There was something sadly, badly, and accusingly wrong about the September 30th report. 2. The year's closing price of 8 1/8 bid was even more of a demonstration of the complete heedlessness of stock market prices than were the original offering price of 13, or the subsequent hot issue advance to a high bid of 28. These latter quotations at least were based on enthusiasm and hope, out of all proportion to reality and common sense, but at least comprehensible. The year-end valuation of $25 million was given to a company that had lost all but a minuscule remnant of its capital, for which a completely insolvent condition was imminent, and for which the words enthusiasm or hope would be only bitter sarcasms. It is true the year-end figures had not been published by December 31st, but it is the business of Wall Street houses associated with a company to have monthly operating statements and a fairly exact idea of how things are going. Final chapter. For the first half of 1970, the company reported a further loss of $1 million. It now had a good-sized capital deficit. It was kept out of bankruptcy by loans made by Mr. Williams, up to a total of $2,500,000. No further statements seem to have been issued, until in January 1971, AAA Enterprises finally filed a petition in bankruptcy. The quotation for the stock at month-end was still 50 cents a share bid, or $1,500,000 for the entire issue, which evidently had no more than wallpaper value. End of our story. Moral and questions. The speculative public is incorrigible. In financial terms, it cannot count beyond three. It will buy anything at any price if there seems to be some action in progress. It will fall for any company identified with franchising, computers, electronics, science, technology, or what have you, when the particular fashion is raging. Our listeners, sensible investors all, are of course above such foolishness. But questions remain. Should not responsible investment houses be honor-bound to refrain from identifying themselves with such enterprises, 9 out of 10 of which may be foredoomed to ultimate failure? This was actually the situation when the author entered Wall Street in 1914. By comparison, it would seem that the ethical standards of the street have fallen rather than advanced in the ensuing 57 years, despite all the reforms and all the controls. Could and should the SEC be given other powers to protect the public, beyond the present ones which are limited to requiring the printing of all important relevant facts in the offering prospectus? Should some kind of box score for public offerings of various types be compiled and published in conspicuous fashion? Should every prospectus, and perhaps every confirmation of sale under an original offering, carry some kind of formal warranty that the offering price for the issue is not substantially out of line with the ruling prices for issues of the same general type already established in the market? As we write this edition, a movement toward reform of Wall Street abuses is underway. It will be difficult to impose worthwhile changes in the field of new offerings because the abuses are so largely the result of the public's own heedlessness and greed. But the matter deserves long and careful consideration. Commentary on Chapter 17. The wisdom god Woden went out to the king of the trolls, got him in an armlock, and demanded to know of him how order might triumph over chaos.
"Give me your left eye," said the troll, "and I'll tell you."
Without hesitation, Woden gave up his left eye.
"Now tell me."
The troll said,
"The secret is, watch with both eyes."
John Gardner. The more things change. Graham highlights four extremes: an overpriced, tottering giant, an empire-building conglomerate, a merger in which a tiny firm took over a big one, an initial public offering of shares in a basically worthless company. The past few years have provided enough new cases of Graham's extremes to fill an encyclopedia. Here is a sampler. Lucent, not transparent. In mid-2000, Lucent Technologies Incorporated was owned by more investors than any other U.S. stock, with a market capitalization of $192.9 billion. It was the 12th most valuable company in America. Was that giant valuation justified? Let's look at some basics from Lucent's financial report for the fiscal quarter ended June 30th, 2000. A closer reading of Lucent's report sets alarm bells jangling like an unanswered telephone switchboard. Lucent had just bought an optical equipment supplier, Chromatis Networks, for $4.8 billion, of which $4.2 billion was goodwill, or cost above book value. Chromatis had 150 employees, no customers, and zero revenues. So the term goodwill seems inadequate. Perhaps hope chest is more accurate. If Chromatis's embryonic products did not work out, Lucent would have to reverse the goodwill and charge it off against future earnings. A footnote discloses that Lucent had lent $1.5 billion to purchasers of its products. Lucent was also on the hook for $350 million in guarantees for money its customers had borrowed elsewhere. The total of these customer financings had doubled in a year, suggesting that purchasers were running out of cash to buy Lucent's products. What if they ran out of cash to pay their debts? Finally, Lucent treated the cost of developing new software as a capital asset. Rather than an asset, wasn't that a routine business expense that should come out of earnings? Conclusion. In August 2001, Lucent shut down the Chromatis division after its products reportedly attracted only two customers. In fiscal year 2001, Lucent lost $16.2 billion. In fiscal year 2002, it lost another $11.9 billion. Included in those losses were $3.5 billion in provisions for bad debts and customer financings, $4.1 billion in impairment charges related to goodwill, and $362 million in charges related to capitalized software. Lucent stock at $51.062 on June 30, 2000, finished 2002 at $1.26. A loss of nearly $190 billion in market value in 2.5 years. The Acquisition Magician. To describe Tyco International Limited, we can only paraphrase Winston Churchill and say that never has so much been sold by so many to so few. From 1997 through 2001, this Bermuda-based conglomerate spent a total of more than $37 billion, most of it in shares of Tyco stock, buying companies the way Imelda Marcos bought shoes. In fiscal year 2000 alone, according to its annual report, Tyco acquired approximately 200 companies, an average of more than one every other day. The result? Tyco grew phenomenally fast. In 5 years, revenues went from $7.6 billion to $34 billion, and operating income shot from a $476 million loss to a $6.2 billion gain. No wonder the company had a total stock market value of $114 billion at the end of 2001. But Tyco's financial statements were at least as mind-boggling as its growth. Nearly every year, they featured hundreds of millions of dollars in acquisition-related charges. These expenses fell into three main categories. 1. Merger or restructuring or other non-recurring costs. 2. Charges for the impairment of long-lived assets. And 3. Write-offs of purchased in-process research and development. For the sake of brevity, let's refer to the first kind of charge as moron, the second as chilla, and the third as whoopaprad. How did they show up over time? As you can see, the moron charges, which are supposed to be non-recurring, showed up in 4 out of 5 years and totaled a whooping $2.5 billion. Chilla cropped up just as chronically and amounted to more than $700 million. Whoopaprad came to another $500 million. The intelligent investor would ask, if Tyco's strategy for growth through acquisition was such a neat idea, how come it had to spend an average of $750 million a year cleaning up after itself? If, as seems clear, Tycho is not in the business of making things, but rather in the business of buying other companies that make things, then why were its moron charges non-recurring? Weren't they just part of Tycho's normal costs of doing business? And with accounting charges for past acquisitions junking up every year's earnings, who could tell what next year's would be? In fact, an investor couldn't even tell what Tycho's past earnings were. In 1999, after an accounting review by the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission, Tycho